Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 469 for March 8th, 2014. This weekend, I'm at a most unusual place, the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philadelphia, at the annual Philadelphia Flower Show. Now, what does whiskey have to do with flowers? I'll explain in a few minutes. In the meantime,
it's one of the worst things you can do is shut down a distillery. So to see so many distilleries reopening now, you know, and new distilleries being built in Scotland and all over the world, I think it's fantastic.
Graham Unson has had a lot of tough jobs in the Scotch whisky industry over the years. He closed down two distilleries, took one out of mothballs, but his current job may be the toughest yet. He took over at Tomaten Distillery for Douglas Campbell when Douglas retired after 53 years at the distillery. And at Tomaten, the distillery manager is essentially the town's mayor, too. More with Graham Unson later on Whiskey Cast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, this week's Your Voice, and much more, all on this week's episode of Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. If you need any more evidence that whiskey is booming these days, Brown-Forman released its third quarter earnings report this week. Sales for the 3 months ending in January were up 5% to nearly $1.1 billion. The various Jack Daniel's whiskeys account for about half of Brown-Forman's annual sales, and were up 8% over the previous year, largely on a big boost in sales for the Tennessee Honey expression. Woodford Reserve sales were up 27%, Old Forester up 25%. Here's another sign. The Bullock family has sold its Loch Lomond Distillery Company in Scotland to a group led by the Exponent private equity firm. The deal includes Loch Lomond and Glen Scotia Distilleries, the High Commissioner Blended Scotch brand, and the Glen Katrine bottling plant. The new management team includes former Diageo and Imperial Tobacco executives. The purchase price was not disclosed. Meanwhile, Sandy Bullock will be taking his profits and staying in the whiskey business. He's planning to build a new distillery in Port Vidi on the shores of Loch Fyne and already has two blended scotches in the works. Yet another new distillery is being built in Scotland, but this one is being built with more than just whiskey in mind. Construction has begun on the Isle of Harris Distillery in Tarbert. The $16.7 million project is being financed by a group of private investors, along with the Scottish Government, Highlands and Islands Enterprise, and the Scottish Investment Bank. Former Glenmorangie executive Simon Erlinger is managing the project, which will create 20 new jobs on the remote island.
It's the brainchild of our founder and chairman, who's had a love affair with Harris going back about 50 years, and who has been saddened by the depopulation of the island. It's halved in the last few decades, and there are just under 2,000 people now living there. Many young people head off to the mainland and elsewhere in search of employment when they reach maturity, and it's been quite a sad demise. And Anderson had this vision of creating something to bring a sense of, first of all, bring some jobs, but also something of longevity, something that would create a sense of pride for the people of Harris, and perhaps act as a catalyst for other industry. And, of course, you know, there isn't anything more long-term in nature, really, than a whiskey distillery. So that's the thinking behind it, which is really quite unusual. This is possibly the first distillery that's been built primarily with the purpose of economic regeneration in mind.
When it's ready, the Harris Distillery's single malt will be known as the Hiroc, which is the Gaelic name for people who live on the Isle of Harris, just like the folks on Islay are known as Illyocks. While almost all of the new jobs will be targeted for Hirocs, Erlinger will need to bring in a distillery manager. He says he'll start looking at candidates in the next few weeks. If you're looking for a distilling job, there's a link for the Harris Distillery's website at whiskeycast.com. On that note, the folks at Wyoming Whiskey have finished their search for Steve Nally's heir apparent. Steve isn't going anywhere anytime soon, but now that Wyoming Whiskey is being sold in Colorado and Texas and will soon be available in other markets as well, the plans are for Steve and his wife Donna to be able to travel more as brand ambassadors. Elizabeth Siraj is the new production manager and apprentice distiller. She's been working at a distillery in Bozeman, Montana. Tormore is one of those distilleries in Scotland that impresses people from the roadside. It's right along the A95 in Speyside and was designed by the renowned architect Sir Albert Richardson. However, its availability as a single malt has been very limited over the years, but Chivas Brothers is replacing the 12-year-old that's been available off and on with two new 14- and 16-year-old expressions, a new packaging design, and a new website. The new Tormore's will be available at first only in France, but will appear in other markets later this year. And the distillery itself, which has never been open to the public on a regular basis, plans to have an open day during the Spirit of Speyside Festival in May. Back in December, we broke the news about Diageo's plans to turn Mortlach into a luxury single malt brand. This week, Diageo unveiled the packaging and pricing for the four expressions in the new Mortlach range that will go on sale this summer. The bottles were designed by the Paris and New York-based design firm Raison Pure, and Diageo's Dr. Nick Morgan says they were inspired by the Cowie family, which ran Mortlach for most of its early years.
George Cowie was an engineer with a wide sort of experience of working in civil engineering projects around the UK, not just in Scotland. And he brought his engineering precision to the way that Mortlach was run and managed, including, for example, putting in railway sidings there as soon as there was an opportunity to, after the Strathspey Railway had been built. Alexander, his son, who we know a little more about, was a spokesperson on behalf of the whiskey industry and was clearly, as a scientist, very much involved in the distillation process. And it's somewhere between George and Alexander that we have to thank for the 2.81 distilled regime that we have at Mortlach, this very, very complex process that produces a very, very distinctive, heavy and meaty spirit character. So in designing the bottles, we wanted to celebrate the Cowies, and we wanted to celebrate more broadly the great Victorian engineering tradition that's so largely writ across Scotland's history. And I think when you see and when your listeners see the bottles, they'll immediately understand where the designers, Raison Pure, have taken their inspiration from in order to produce, I think, bottles that are truly unique in terms of Scotch whisky and bottles that will be iconic, I think, in terms of Mortlach.
And the bottles will actually come in two different sizes, correct?
That's right. In Asia and Europe, the bottles will be at a 50 cl size. In North America, regulations don't allow us to use that size, so we'll be going on the standard 75, 750. Size for NA.
Because of the different bottle sizes, the North American pricing has not yet been determined, but the 500 cl bottles for the rest of the world are going to be pricey. The UK pricing for the flagship Mortlach Rare Old will be £55, or about $92 a bottle. The 18-year-old will be £180, or $300, and the 25-year-old £600, $1,000. That has generated some controversy online, as you might expect. I'll have some of your feedback later on Your Voice. Meanwhile, Diageo is adding two variations to its Singleton of Dufton malt that's available in Europe. Tailfire uses a higher proportion of European oak casks, while Sunray uses more ex-bourbon casks. One of the sure signs that spring is coming is the unveiling of Woodford Reserve's annual Kentucky Derby commemorative bottle. This year, Louisville artist David O. Schuster's painting The Fourth Turn will be on the bottle. The 1-liter bottles will go on sale throughout the U.S. later this month. The Kentucky Derby will be run at Churchill Downs on May 3rd. Another sure sign that spring is coming is the annual Philadelphia Flowers Show, where I am this weekend. Now, what in the world does whiskey have to do with flowers? Well, for Jim Rutledge of Four Roses, there's a logical connection. Four Roses unveiled a new single barrel bottling this weekend at the Flower Show that's exclusive to the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board's Fine Wines and Good Spirits stores. Jim is signing bottles this weekend at the Flower Show. That is, while they last.
I think the yield was 26, six bottle cases. We're down to about 15 bottles left for sale right now. It's been a great day.
In one day?
In one day, I think. Yeah, and it's I was on the phone with them when they were selecting it in Pennsylvania, just going through and talking through the process. But I was amazed when I've tasted this bottle, and it's, of course, bottled at barrel strength. We've only removed the charcoal. and left all the flavor there, and it's amazing. It's almost 117 proof, 116.8 proof, and the mellowness, the smoothness, a bourbon drinker would never guess it probably over 95 or 6 proof. It's amazing.
For the Four Roses fans out there who know the yeast recipes and know the mash bills and know those four-letter codes, what's the code on this one and the specifics?
It's an OBSV, which is the recipe we use for our regular single barrel. Although it's aged longer, it was aged 10 years, 11 months. And I know there's a lot of connoisseurs that really look at warehouses. I really do not have people. I'm often asked, do you have a favorite warehouse, the sweet spots? Well, we don't have sweet spots because we use the single-story rack warehouses rather than multi-story warehouses. This barrel was aged on the east side of M Warehouse, the second tier, second tier, and V, whatever number that is in the alphabet, that deep into that rack. So it's east side of M Warehouse, second aisle, second tier. We rack our barrels 6 tiers high in single-story rack warehouses, and V that deep into the rack where this barrel sat the entire time it's being aged.
Now, while we're talking about single barrels, we're still a few weeks away from the 2014 limited edition single barrel release, I know. What can you tell us about this year's single barrel limited edition?
Not a lot. OESF, I'm sorry. Was it 13 years, I think, age? And, this was selected. We selected this lot probably in December that we would use. Now, we've gone through and approved this lot of barrels. Now, the final selection of barrels, and we'll probably go through about, I'm going to guess around 40, 45 barrels. I'm not sure. And it may be over 100 candidates. I have yet, it'll be the next week that I'll go through and approve every barrel that will be bottled and approved for bottling for the limited edition. So, and that's why I say I can't tell you a lot. I can tell you the recipe, the age, but I can tell you it'll be good.
I'll have my tasting notes for this year's limited edition single barrel when it's available later this spring. And finally, another note from bourbon, and in this case, rye country. Lexington's Town Branch Distillery is releasing a straight rye whiskey to go along with its bourbon and the Pierce Lions Reserve single malt. The Town Branch rye will be available in Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio over the next several weeks. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at whiskeycast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie, introducing Glenmorangie Companta, the fifth release in the Glenmorangie Private Edition range. A complex maturation in both Burgundy and Côte d'Aronne French red wine barriques. Find out more at glenmorangie.com.
The latest episode of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings is online now. This time around, we brought together two brothers who don't get to see each other more than once or twice a year for a Skype-based tasting. David and Kevin Lavin, along with Kevin's girlfriend Stephanie Bookert, did a blind tasting of the Speyburn 10-year-old, the Aaron 14-year-old, and the Talisker Storm single malts. You can listen to WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings at WhiskeyCast.com or download it from iTunes. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. The announcement on Diageo's recommended pricing for the new Mortlach single malts brought some cries of outrage from whiskey lovers online. And by some, I mean a lot. Here's one example that's pretty much in line with a lot of the commenters. Danny Williamson posted this on our Facebook page. Bit of a price hike, eh? Especially for the 18 over the 16. This is where the age statements don't matter sentiment is bull. I could get 16-year-old Mortlach Flora and Fauna for £60. Now the price of similar-aged stuff has trebled, but it's okay, because I can get a no-age statement version for a similar price, though only two-thirds of the amount I could get before. We're not being ripped off at all. The whiskey companies have us right where they want us. Now, as I said, that's just one comment, but it is representative of the overall sentiment online this week following the announcement. With all of the new distillery announcements we've been seeing recently, is there a point at which things may be going too far? Christopher Winters of Indiana posted this comment on the start of construction for the Isle of Harris distillery. I think you can have too many distilleries. As much as I love Scotch whiskey, Scotland, and visiting them, I fear history could repeat itself. Recall the boom in distilleries being built in the 1890s and many not surviving. I wish all the new ones good luck, especially Daft Mill, which I visited in 2012. Brad Halpin of Seattle sent along this note on the story we did back in January on Westland Distillery. After a recent episode featuring Westland Distillery, I decided to check them out since they're local. Well, it turned out their latest release party was this weekend for their first peated American single malt, and it was great. Even at only 26 months, I was quite impressed with the flavor and depth, though I can't wait to try it with another few years under its belt. I also saw some of their massive sherry butts they use for aging, and I'm told a single barrel cask strength release will be out soon with more to follow. I'm getting very excited about these guys. Thanks for running that segment on them. Well, you can find my tasting notes for that first peated single malt from Westland at whiskeycast.com. Finally, John Birkbeck from Cardiff, Wales and the South Wales Whiskey Interest Group emailed me some details on a Gordon and MacPhail tasting coming up on Monday night, but he had an ulterior motive in mind. Here's what he wrote. If I'm honest, I'm really only letting you know to see if you'd attempt the pronunciation of the town on the show. To get you started, the double L is a soft CL sound, and the F's are gentle V's. And before I try to pronounce it, I'll spell it for you. It's L-L-A-N-F-R-E-C-H-F-A. I love challenges like this. And if I'm right, the town is pronounced Clanvechra, and the tasting is Monday night at the Gate at Clanvechra. And if there's something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at whiskeycast.com, or you can email me directly. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. You can follow me on Facebook and Twitter at whiskeycast2. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's U.S. chapter has a tasting coming up on March 20th in Salt Lake City. The Kensington Wine Market in Calgary, Alberta has ancient malts tastings on the 20th and the 21st with the same lineup of whiskeys each night. Whiskey Live London is coming up March 21st and 22nd. The Trondheim Whiskey Festival is on the 22nd in Trondheim, Norway. The Whiskey Obsession Festival is March 27th and 28th in Sarasota, Florida. And the Malmö Beer and Whiskey Festival is March 28th and 29th in Malmö, Sweden. Those are just some of the nearly 300 different whiskey events on the searchable calendar at whiskeycast.com. There's bound to be one near you. The calendar of events is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Billy Lighton, master blender, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
The sherry butts in particular have a big impact on the flavour of Redbreast. It gives it the deep, dried, fruity notes, which is probably the signature of Redbreast. Take a sip, hold it in my mouth for minutes, and just dissect it and pick up all the little fruity notes. There's something that I didn't notice before. Whenever you leave your glass of Redbreast sitting there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you can go back to it and go, oh, something's changed there. Why is that changing? How is it changing? Is this something that I should be picking up on, you know? It's fascinating. And I mean, I've been in the business 34 years and it still excites me, you know, things like this.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
It's always a sad day for whiskey lovers when a distillery closes its doors, but it's even harder for the people who worked there. Graham Jensen is the manager now at Tomaten Distillery in the Highlands, but he's closed down two distilleries and reopened one during his career. We talked following his recent master class at the Victoria Whiskey Festival.
The sense of achievement when you reopen a distillery, especially one that was closed for 22 years, was absolutely fantastic. The saddest thing I have ever done was when we mothballed Scarpa and then mothballed Glendronach. Thankfully, they've both come back to life again. But the day that the Stills ran for the last time was sad. You know, it's I'm not an overly emotional sort of guy, but there was a tear in the eye, I would say, on that occasion. So it's one of the worst things you can do is shut down a distillery. So to see so many distilleries reopening now, you know, and new distilleries being built in Scotland and all over the world, I think it's fantastic. You know,
tell me about that last day at Scapa.
Well, that was December 1993. I remember not so much the last day itself as the run-up to that, when the bosses came into the distillery and told us that the distillery was going to be mothballed, it was shutting down, the warehouses would continue to operate, but there would be no more production. And then they took me through to a side room and said, well, you've heard that, Graham, but it's not going to affect you because you're moving to Glendronach. And I said, well, you know, okay. I had never even considered leaving Orkney in my life. I refused to go to university because it meant leaving Orkney. And then all of a sudden, it was a case of I had no choice, really. And I loved it. I mean, Glendronach was a great place to work. But it was really sad, the guys, because we were doing all the work. We were stripping down the mill. We were oiling everything. We were opening up the boiler and oiling it so none of it would rust. You know, and it was just pretty demoralizing to actually be doing that, because we had no idea how long it was going to be closed for. You know, so it's not nice. It wasn't nice.
And then in the end, it was closed for about 10 years or so, if I remember right?
Well, no, it wasn't quite as long as that, because what happened eventually was that Edrington, who owned Highland Park, which is only a couple of miles away from Scapa, their staff in the summer, when Highland Park was closed down for annual maintenance, would come down and run the plant at Scapa for about 6 weeks. So it actually started up just a few years after the closure. That it was run for 6 weeks in the summer just to keep some stock going there. Some of the guys who used to work at Scapa were actually re-employed up at Highland, so they were coming back to run it for 6 weeks. But by that time I was gone. I had moved south to the mainland of Scotland, the small islands off the coast of Orkney called Scotland. Yeah. So.
Did Edrington own Scapa back then, or?
No, it was Allied Distillers that owned it, who became Allied Domecq, and then eventually became part of Chivas Pernod Ricard. But it was Allied that owned Scapa at the time. Edrington owned Highland Park at that time.
And then you go down to Glendronach.
Yep.
Same thing happens all over again.
Yeah, I mean, Glendronach was, when I was there, it was fantastic because they still had the coal-fired stills. We still operated the floor maltings. It was a really, really traditional distillery. My daughter was born in the time I was there, so I have really fond memories of Glendronach. But again, there was a downturn in the whiskey industry. That would be 1996. You know, at the moment it's riding on the crest of a wave. Back then, they didn't need all the production facilities that they had. They sold some of their distilleries off, likes of Bal Blair and Pulteney were ex-Allied ones that got sold off, but they decided to close Glendronach down for a few years again. So that was when I thought, well, it's not for me being in a business that this is happening. So I applied for a job as assistant manager at Glenmorangie and was lucky enough to get it. And then within 18 months got promoted to manager at Morangie. And the way I looked at it was a brand the size of Glenmorangie, if that was going to close down, we were in a really bad state, the whole whisky industry. But since then, obviously, it started to build up, and now there's distilleries expanding and being opened and reopened, and everything is good, so long may that continue to be the case.
When you're back on Orkney and you drive out by the Scapa Flow and you see the place, what memories come back?
Oh, it's difficult to put it into words. It was the first distillery I worked at, therefore I'm always going to have seriously fond memories of it, because it was all new to me. I knew nothing about whisky, really, when I went to Scapa to work. I went there to push casks in the warehouse as a labourer. I was just very lucky that, well, I worked 8 days in the warehouse, actually, then went off and got married, came back from honeymoon and got called into the manager's office to be told that there was a job going to be going in the mash house on shift. A few months down the line, one of the guys was leaving to go and work in the oil industry. So I was only in the warehouses for a few months, but even that was a great learning curve for me, because you learn some of the practicalities of timing the casks and, you know, how best to handle them. You learn some of the techniques. It's not rocket science, but it makes life a hell of a lot easier if you know the simple ways of doing things. So I then worked in the mash house and then into the still house. And then eventually got asked if I would go into the administration side, become a trainee brewer, as they called it. So that all took place in the matter of just a few years. You know, so I was really lucky to be in that sort of position at that time. And I learned with some of the greatest guys in the world, you know, the old guys working at Scapa. In fact, there's a brewer there, he's actually a distillery manager now, but he was a brewer at the time. I probably learned more from him than I have from anyone else in the industry. But he's not a showman. He would never do something like this. He's too quiet. He would play his guitar and sing, but he would never stand up and speak in front of the public. But I learned more from him than probably anyone else.
And give us his name so he gets the credit.
His name is Fred Sinclair. He's a manager at, he was at Pulteney for a while, but he's at Balmenich now, down in Cromdale in the middle of Speyside. So he's about to retire in about 2 months' time from now. So he'll be a loss to the industry.
So you close a couple down, mm-hmm. You go to Glenmorangie, yeah. You don't close that one down, despite, as you joked earlier, your best attempts, and then you get the chance to go revive Glenglassaugh.
Yep.
What's it like going into a distillery that's been mothballed and bringing it back to life?
Well, the first day I actually went there to start work was April Fool's Day. It was the 1st of April. And I went in, and in Glenglassaugh there's a balcony, a concrete balcony you can stand on and look down onto the stills. And I remember standing on that balcony, looking down at the corroded stills, all the broken pipework. There was no electricity in the place. And I thought, what the hell have I done here? You know, I left one of the most beautiful still houses in the world at Glenmorangie and went to this place. But even on that day when I thought, what have I done, looking at it, it was a case of, well, yeah, but kind of a real impact on this. You know, working at Glenmorangie, beautiful still house, great brand, nice people, but you're only really a custodian passing through. You're not really getting the chance to influence anything that much. When you go to somewhere like Glenglassaugh, which has had no influence for the last 22 years, you have to make all the judgment calls on what to do and how to do it. But you also, you know that right from the outset, I knew that this was going to be a huge project. But it appealed to me. It appealed to the sort of romantic notion of bringing something back to life. My wife would argue I don't have any romance in my body, but when it comes to whiskey, I do.
But then comes time to move on. And you wind up taking over for a legend at Tomaten in Douglas Campbell,
yeah.
Who was honored by the Queen this past year with an MBE, and we've talked with him before. What's it like going into a distillery where you're taking over for not only the distillery manager, but when everybody lives in those houses around the distillery, essentially, he's the mayor of Tomaten for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, the good thing is I knew Douglas. I knew Dougie well before I joined Tomaten. He's too well known in the industry for me not to have met him. But ultimately, I knew at the time that I couldn't be overawed by the fact that he had been there 53 years type idea. It was because, no, I have to go in and make my own mark on this, but at the same time, be respectful to what he has achieved, you know, in his 5 decades of working there. You couldn't just go in and try and change everything overnight and say, that's all wrong, because most of what they do is obviously all right, you know. So tweaking bits here and there with ideas that were probably slightly more modern. Because the one downside, and this is no disrespect to Douglas, is that if you work in the one place for 50 years, you don't get the chance to learn the best practice from other distilleries. So the fact that I've now been at 5 distilleries means that I've experienced different problems, different solutions, and seen best practice in a lot of places, so that I could include some of that in the way that Tomaten's run without changing the traditions. You know, try and improve things here and there wherever I could type idea. So that Douglas still works with us. He still does some brand's ambassadorial role. So I don't think we'll ever get him to fully retire. We'll have to beat him to death with a stick to get him to stop working. But it's great to have him around, that I can go and ask him questions and ask him what, you know, about the history of the place, how they used to do things, why they changed it and such like. So it's a great font of knowledge to have there, to have him on site. He still lives on site, actually. He's still in one of the main houses at the distillery. So he's easily accessed to find out what they used to do and why it all changed, and reintroduce some things and change other things. No, it's good fun.
Now, they gave you a chance to put your own stamp on the distillery,
yeah,
with the creation of Tomaten Legacy.
Yep.
And I don't think it was ever really explained very well to the rest of us outside of the Tomaten immediate family how Legacy was created last year when you released it. Explain how it was created, because this is one where you actually involved the family of workers that live, work, and breathe around Tomaten.
Yeah, exactly. What we did was we were looking to create a whiskey that was entry point, price-wise, but also in style, so it was easy to drink for someone coming new to malt whiskey. It would appeal to a younger audience and maybe even to a feminine palate to a certain extent as well. But what we did was we looked at our stock profile to see what casks we had, and then I did some mixing and matching of various recipes. Had about 8 or 9 of them at one point, but in a small group with guys with good noses, basically they work with me at the distillery, we nosed a few of them and said, no, we don't want that, we don't like that, that's not really the style we're after. So we narrowed it down to just a couple. And then we just put them blind nosing, said sample A, sample B, and gave everyone in the distillery a chance to come and have a nose and a taste. They could even take it home with them if they wanted and do it of an evening with their family, their wives, their husbands, their sons and daughters, whatever, to nose and taste the whisky and come back and let us know which one they preferred. So that it was really a team decision. It was democracy, basically, chose the final recipe that went into the legacy, which I think is a good thing. You know, we could have done it differently. It could have been just 2 or 3 of us that made the final decision. But if you do that, I like that style of whiskey, therefore I would like, you know, that product. Now, I may be able to push that too hard, whereas by opening it up to 49 people plus their respective partners to actually choose the final one meant that it was more akin to getting a straw poll, you know, asking the public what they want, rather than landing up being maybe 2 or 3 of us with our own personal preconceived ideas of what whisky should be. So I think it's a great way to do it, actually.
And it really is a family in more ways than one. You've got a lot of people who are second, third generations, husbands and wives working at the place, mothers and daughters, fathers and sons, and so forth, so on. Yep. Explain just how this all works, because a lot of us don't really see that anymore at distilleries where entire families are there.
Yeah, it is quite unusual. I mean, one of the reasons is because it's quite remote. That's historically why it's happened, because it's not been an easy place to get to. You can get to it now in 15 minutes driving from Inverness, so that's no longer the case. But we still have the tradition of keeping people on site. And you do have families there. So going back to Douglas Campbell, his father worked at the distillery, and his son Colin now works in the distillery as well. So that's 3 generations that have been there. But it is quite common at Tomaten for there to be husbands and wives. As I mentioned earlier, our company secretary, Kitty, has just got married, well, two years ago almost now, to Clinton Davis, who's the assistant with Head Wherisman. You know, they met at the distillery, and love blossomed, and, you know, they're now expecting their first child as well. So that's all good. That's the next generation of workers to come into the distillery is about to be born sometime, later this year. So that it is nice to have that. It's not without its difficulties, because obviously families feud amongst themselves, you know, we all do. And when you're working with your family and living side by side with the family, it can be quite close-knit, and there can be domestic disputes, let's say, at times, and arguments, and you get people not speaking. But that happens in all walks of life. Probably the positive side is that although that happens, they have to get back on speaking terms because they live side by side. But it's the most positive thing about it is the fact that living on site, they live and breathe Tomaten. You know, the Tomaten distillery is their life, inside and outside of work, and that engenders so much passion for the place. You know, that most of the staff we have working on site, they'll go the extra mile to help if ever it's needed, you know, and that's not a common thing nowadays to get staff that are like that, you know. So we like to think we look after them quite well, but they definitely look after us very well. You know, the employees will go that extra mile for us.
Tell me about Kubakken, because the peated version of Tomaten that we'd never seen before until a few months ago comes out and really has gotten a lot of really good reviews. And it's to the point now where you might actually be consider expanding that range a little bit.
Yes, it is. I mean, the Kubakken, for the last 10, 11 years, for 2 weeks or so every December, we've done some lightly peated malt, about 15 to 18 parts per million is the sort of general range that it was in. So small volumes each year, but we've never actually gone ahead to sell it. But now that has really come of age, we decided that the time was probably right to launch it. But because it's so different to the standard Tomaten range, which is unpeated, we decided to put it under the Kubokan banner, Kubokan being Gaelic for ghost dog. The story goes along with that as well about the ghost of the last wolf killed in Scotland type idea. But the basic concept was to have a really, really good quality whiskey. So we use the best of casks, first fill ex-bourbon, first fill Oloroso sherry, virgin oak, and only a small amount of refill casks. So less than 20% of the bulk going into the whiskey is in refill casks. The rest of it's all in first fill or even brand new oak cask. So the quality of whiskey you get from that is really up there at the top. And that's what we wanted to do, was have, it's still not an old whiskey. Yes, it really is just the last 11 years we've been doing this, so I'll give you an idea of the age of casks we have. So that by doing this really top-end quality casks with this lightly peated malt, it gives us a different expression. But it has been so well met all over the world whenever we've launched it that there's no point in just having the one expression, I don't think. We need to look around and see what we can do. We do potentially have as little as four or five casks of older stock which was peated by accident. I'm not quite sure how it happened, but having spoken to one of our mashmen who's been 25 years with the company, he remembers a load of malt coming in that they were convinced was peated, but the maltster said, no, it wasn't. But he said he could smell it in the distillery. So this may actually be some of that is still in cask in the way it's not been used. But small volumes, but that may be an older expression of Kubokan that could come out. And then, well, you saw here today, some of the constituent parts are absolutely fantastic in their own right. So the heavily sherried Oloroso sherry finish, or Oloroso sherry matured, because it's a full maturation, maybe a standalone version of Kubokan, you know, that people, certainly the guys and girls here today, absolutely loved it. You know, so I might go back and explain that to the marketing department back at the distillery, that look, you know, if we've got sufficient of this, that could be another line extension, just to give people more opportunity to try different expressions. Because at the end of the day, that's what whiskey's all about, is trying different recipes, different formulas, to see what you like. And there will be a nice whiskey out there for someone, you know. So we all have our own favourites, but there's no harm in having lots of favourites.
Maybe even a cask strength version?
You never know. Watch this space, basically. Watch this space.
So are you done moving around now? Are you going to settle down for a while in Tomaten?
I would like to think so. I would like to think I'll hopefully see out the last of my career there. I don't really have any ambition to move on again, because there is so much potential with Tomaten. Given that it was the biggest distillery in Scotland at one time, there's still a lot of potential there. So that I can see a lot of years ahead of me of having some real fun with some quality whiskies that have been lying around in the warehouses.
You can find my tasting notes for the Tomaten Legacy and Kubokan at the WhiskeyCast website. As for the What I'm Tasting This Week department, my nose decided to get stuffed and took the week off. Wish I could smell the flowers around here, but things should be back to normal next week. In the meantime, you'll find my searchable tasting notes for more than 1,100 different whiskeys at WhiskeyCast.com. That's also where you'll find links for WhiskeyCast virtual tastings and WhiskeyCast HD episodes, the latest whiskey news and the calendar of events, my photo gallery and print shop, and a complete archive of past episodes. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at WhiskeyCast, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. I'd love to hear from you.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2014, and comes to you this week from the Philadelphia Flower Show. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.